Hi, this is Justine Toe, and before we get into this week's Life and Faith episode, I'd like to tell you about a new CPX podcast. It's called The Week at CPX, and it's where we tell you all the stuff that's happening at CPX and sprinkle in some commentary on the side. But why another podcast, we hear you ask? Well, it's a bit of a long story, and here's a short version. Recently, the company that own Facebook and Instagram has had some disagreements with the Australian government over news on social media. Now, while we're not a news organisation per se, much of our content is categorised as such, and according to Meta, we're sort of on the chopping block for groups who are going to be impacted. So if you like CPX and want to keep up with what we're doing, but are a little social media'd out, The Week at CPX is for you. We're going to talk about articles, interviews, upcoming projects, and our views on some current events and other things we're thinking about. Never more than 10 minutes. Never the same stuff each week. Subscribe today so you don't miss an episode. Now, on with Life and Faith.
This week on Life and Faith.
It might seem as if the entirety of the cosmos was a bit of a put-up job, that the principle of life and mind and maybe even love and communion was built in to the fabric right from the beginning.
Nothing that we had done had made any meaningful difference for these people. Now, the Taliban were back in control of that country.
Once you believe in one conspiracy theory, you start believing a lot more of them.
They're kind of universal.
Why don't we make good things happen instead?
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart. Major scientific and technical advances, especially things like AI or medical technology, like efforts to extend life or manipulate genes, are often met with the warning, we shouldn't be playing God. Now, the sense here is that human ingenuity can, in certain circumstances, overreach with terrible consequences. But in their most recent book, Nick Spencer and Hannah Waite turn that idea somewhat on its head, although with some important nuance. They argue that we are a God-playing species, and that remains an important part of who we are. In addressing AI and alien life and attempts to achieve immortality, as well as a bunch of other fascinating subjects, Spencer and Waite say they keep coming back to the question of who we are as human beings. The book is Playing God: Science, Religion, and the Future of Humanity. And Nick Spencer, an old friend of CPX, joined me from his home in England to talk about it. Early in the book, the authors say that the progress science is making raises exactly the kinds of questions that science can't answer. They believe it's a huge mistake to section off science from other important areas of human inquiry, including religion. So that was the first thing I wanted to ask Nick about.
I guess it's important to do a bit of intellectual archaeology here. About 400 years ago, when science as we understand it today gets going, it was called natural philosophy or experimental natural philosophy at the time. It drew a lot of inspiration from an English statesman and philosopher called Francis Bacon, who helped move science away from Aristotelian science. Aristotelian science, very complex, very sophisticated, but it posited that there were four causes for things, four different causes, reasons why things happen. And one of those causes was a final cause, a teleological cause. In other words, things were drawn towards their ends. And Francis Bacon said that wasn't the case. And for science to be science, it should only be interested in what he called material causes and immanent causes. Now, that meant that for the next 400 years, science was extremely successful, but it was successful precisely because it bracketed out teleological thinking. It bracketed out final causes. Now, we're at the stage when we are able, and I'm sure we'll come on to talk about this, to modify creation in the most profound way, to modify human beings in the most profound way. But the question then comes, well, to what ends?
Yeah.
What are you trying to achieve by modifying humans or modifying creation? Now, as it happens, that's always been a question that kind of runs in parallel with science. That's why you always need to embed science and ethics. But we argue in the book that's going to become so much more of an issue in the 21st century because we're so very adept at doing it. So we're reintroducing not so much final causes, but thinking about teleology, thinking about ends into our mix here.
And you need more than science to do that.
You do. That's why, as I said, science is very, very successful because it focuses on imminent and material causes. And you need a wider sort of context of humanistic disciplines, philosophy and theology and anthropology and so on and so forth, to help guide and steer and inform that scientific progress.
Absolutely. So let's just jump in because you deal with some fascinating topics. So the science of immortality, or perhaps extending life beyond what's currently possible. It was a little bit surprising to me how many people say that they don't want to live forever or even to 200 or whatever.
It is, isn't it? We conducted research as part of the background project for this book, and actually it's not hugely popular. In one sense, I'm actually quite reassured about this, and I think it draws on the fact that if you consider immortality to be an extension of the organism as it is for a very, very long time, most people realise that actually that's a bit bleak. That can be really quite alienating and isolating and not particularly inspiring. I think there are other ways of looking at life extension, immortality, that might be more appealing. But on that very basic level, it doesn't really scratch where people are itching.
Yeah, without something else, it felt to people like it might be a bit desperate. But plenty of people do, of course, look for this. And we have some incredible sounding efforts like the cryogenics industry. There's some people going to extreme lengths there.
Yeah, I mean, the chapter gets properly gothic in places. there are about 500 people at the moment who are cryogenically frozen. This is basically when pretty much as soon as you die, you have your body pumped full of liquid nitrogen, I think it is, and stored upside down in a giant refrigerator in the hope that at some point or other, scientists in the future might be able to resurrect you. You're stored upside down because if the power fails and you thaw from the top down. Some people are decapitated and have only their heads frozen. Some people have chosen to cryogenically freeze their pets, dogs, cats. Apparently there's a chinchilla somewhere or other. And it's not appealing. One of the people we interviewed for the research project, who was a fully paid up atheist, said, look, I'd much rather end my life, end my days in an English country churchyard rather than the Californian freezer.
The idea that we could perhaps upload our brains into some sort of supercomputer or virtual afterlife is sort of the transhumanist dream. You talk a bit about this in the book, but what's missing from that dream?
Well, you're right. The cryogenics is a very, very primitive form of scientific immortality. There are much more sophisticated versions. There's the uploading version that you're talking about. That is predicated on the idea that humans are processing machines. The brain is a ginormous computer. If you are able to freeze and record that information processing machine at a certain point, you can take that information, which is what you are, and transfer it to a different medium, upload it into the cloud, so to speak. And that will allow you, because you are information, to exist in some other format. One of the, I think, real problems with that, and actually this features more in our chapter on AI, is that it completely ignores our embodiment. It might be possible, I don't personally think it is, but it might be possible to understand us as information processing machines, but that ignores our physical presence in the world and the fact that our existence is predicated on that embodiment. And with that embodiment comes certain kind of vulnerabilities and fragilities that I said are particularly important when you start thinking about AI. So quite apart from anything else, this uploading thing is certainly at the more science fiction end of this particular immortality spectrum. But it, I think, is based on a faulty conception of the human. And time again, as you see throughout the book, we keep on coming back to, well, at heart of so many of these debates is our conception of how do we understand the human.
Let's talk about AI, because that again is a really interesting chapter in the book. It's so much part of discussions around the future at the moment, and the last few years has sort of escalated, seems to have very much. But can you talk about what lies behind our fears of AI and what it might do? What's sitting there as people become concerned about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's rooted, if you're thinking about our fears of AI, I think it's rooted in a similar kind of fear that has plagued humans forever, which is a fear of the other. In this instance, the other is something that we have created, which then rebels against its master. Mm. I mean, there are more watered down fears, which are, for example, if AI becomes conscious, brackets, whatever exactly that means, and sentient and intelligent, we no longer seem to be so special. In fact, we might be a lot less special, because if they're intelligent, arguably they're going to be much more intelligent than we are, because they can remember much more, they can process much more. So there's a fear of losing our uniqueness. There's a fear of being knocked off the top perch. There's a fear of actually the servant becoming the master and rebelling against us and the machines taking over. For various reasons, I don't actually think they are particularly legitimate fears. I've got a much greater concern, which is not that the AI will use AI to erode our humanity and our security. It's that other human beings will use AI to erode our humanity and our security. And if you want an exhibit for that, let's just wait to the US elections towards the end of this year and see how influential deep fakes are.
Yes, that is a scary thought. And certainly part of the package of the fears is a sort of anxiety around it, as well as, well, it depends who you are. Some people are super excited by it all. You see some exciting potential there too, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's probably worth, maybe I should have said this right out front, that the book is called Playing God, not to support the familiar warning that humans shouldn't play God in all these circumstances, but actually, on the contrary, to argue that humans are a God playing species. That's what we're here to do. We have particular rational, communicative, imaginative, creative capacities, and theologically speaking, a mandate to garden creation, if you like, to be co-regents with God, to act on his behalf. So we should, in principle, welcome and encourage and fund, but as well regulate all these different scientific disciplines we're talking about. It absolutely is no solution at all to say, oh, we shouldn't be doing this. On the contrary, we should be doing it. We just should be doing it right.
But are you convinced by the proponents of AI who say, well, yes, there are real dangers here, but as long as we regulate it well and get everyone to agree on ethically agreed principles, that it'll all be fine? Now, you might hear that I'm somewhat skeptical of that myself, but are you more optimistic about that?
Well, I mean, in principle, I don't think there's anything to disagree with there. But as I understand it, I'm no industry insider here by any means. But as I understand it, that emphatically isn't what's happening at the moment. Or more to the point, the attempts to do it, they're slow in comparison to the progress that's being made. I mean, someone said to me that effectively this is being governed by the logic of the market. And if I don't develop the next AI tool, my competitor will, and my shareholders will not forgive that, so I better be the first to market. And when you're dealing with a technology of this power and this extraordinary capacity, that's a perilous space to be in.
You did mention this a bit before, but I think this is really worth sort of pressing into a little bit more. You talk about the fact that there are you identify kind of two very diametrically opposed positions, that AI is going to surpass human intelligence with the information processing, and that they'll be able to do it all better, and that's what's happening. Another says it can never attain anything like humanity because it doesn't have a soul. And both, you say, fail on this point of the disregard for the body, the embodiment of human beings. Why is that so important?
So the misstep we make here is that, as I said, with regard to the answer I gave to do with scientific immortality, we reduce humanity to computational power, effectively, or rationality becomes the quintessential human characteristic. Rationality is information processing. Machines are better at processing information than we are, therefore they're more rational, therefore they're more human. And that ignores the very fact the body, and the body is extremely important because our presence in the world gives us a stake in the world. There are certain goods that you and I need as embodied beings, Simon. There are certain bads that we seek to avoid. That is an absolute fundamental basis of our orientation to the world, our sense of what is good and what is bad, what should be pursued, what should be avoided, what we want to achieve. It also critically gives us, that embodiment gives us a vulnerability, because there are bads that would effectively end our existence. It gives us a fragility, It gives us a temporality. We exist in time. And it gives us a dependence. We effectively need others to help us achieve our personal goals and our shared goals. Now, all of that is formative to our entire moral and existential outlook. Having goods, needing to cooperate, wanting to avoid bad, so on and so forth. What is the equivalent of that in AI? The conclusion we come to there is that, in principle, I don't have an objection to the idea that AI could become human in that sense. But don't give me the fact that it can process 5 petabytes of data in 5 seconds as a justification for me respecting its existence. Processing power, I think, is by and large peripheral to this issue. I'll be impressed when it has to source its own resources to stay alive, in other words, to feed, and dispense of its own waste products in order to maintain a clear and clean environment. Brackets, we're not doing brilliantly at that at the moment. I think they're the things that really matter here.
Yeah, so I was really moved by that, the fragility of our human existence, which is something we lament at one level, but also feels like it's something particularly human about it, which leads into that interrelationality. That's key here, that's missing in these other attempts, perhaps.
It is, and also we are so fixated, particularly in the Western world, on autonomy. Autonomy yes. seems to us to be not only a good, but the supreme good and, you know, an incomparable good. Now, I'm not even sure I know what autonomy means, if I'm honest with you. As a human being, I'm so caught up in my relational networks that autonomy doesn't honestly make a great deal of sense. But even if I can understand what it means, I don't live my life that way. I catch public transport to work. You know, I just to take a mundane example, we live in webs of dependence whereby autonomy is really a question of whom you ask help from.
You're listening to Life and Faith, and I'm speaking with Nick Spencer, the author, along with Hannah Waite, of Playing God. Now, as Nick says, these modern questions that emerge from our attempts to navigate the world with incredible scientific advances keep driving us back to the question of who we are as human beings, and also the personhood that that grants us. Now, that's a bit of a complex idea, and Nick will explain it. That we know so much more about the capacities of animals now has led some to ask whether they shouldn't be granted personhood. What would that mean for humans and for non-human rights? Here's Nick Spencer again.
That chapter begins with the sad story of Happy. Happy is a 51-year-old Asian elephant that's been held in Bronx Zoo for many years or so. The Non-Human Rights Project has been vigorously campaigning and taking her case before the courts that her personhood, her legal personhood, should be required. There are some very, very interesting precedents here. Let's not forget that legal personhood was denied for ethnic minorities in many countries, but in this case in America, for a long time, because they weren't deemed to be a person. So one has to be very careful here before you say absolutely not. Courts tend to say this is just too big an issue for us. Rightly, I think, because legal personhood has to be predicated on metaphysical personhood, on a philosophical idea of what a person is. So then the question becomes, what is a person? Try and cut a very long and complex argument down. There are two different concepts of person that we've inherited in the world. One tends to be based on capacities. Something qualifies as a person because it has certain capacities, rationality, consciousness, sentience, that kind of thing. The other concept is more of a relational concept of personhood, which comes from Christian theology originally. Personhood is almost like a place in which relationships connect, a place of communion, effectively, of relational interaction. And I think if you go down the first line of capacities, you probably could make a case that animals, some animals, were persons, although you'd have a hellishly difficult job in determining which animals were persons and which weren't.
And that's through what sorts of things, though? What's that through? What's that come from?
So one of my intellectual heroes, who sadly died just a few months ago, Frans de Waal, a Dutch primatologist, has written brilliantly about how in the last 40, 50 years or so, our picture of what animals are capable of doing has been completely transformed. We now recognise they are extremely intelligent, many of them use something that comes close to, they communicate in a way that comes close to having a language. They have empathy, they have reflection, they have planning. Some of them even might even have moral reflection. And so the old idea, the behaviourist idea that they were basically empty shells, or the Cartesian ideas that the beast was a machine, doesn't hold water anymore. And, you know, primatologists and zoologists will show that, you know, animals like Happy and Kiku, which is a chimpanzee that the Non-Human Rights Project are also campaigning on behalf of, have real capacities. And also, and this is where the argument from Peter Singer and utilitarianism comes in, he lies at the heart of the Non-Human Rights Project, or at its origins. If your real question is not whether it thinks, but whether it feels, then you could make a good argument that there are some animals that show greater empathic and cognitive capacities than some humans, in particular humans in a persistent vegetative state or in late stages of Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, and therefore the former respect demand more respect than the latter. That's not an argument that has won many allies amongst the disability community, self-evidently. But going on the capacities-based approach to personhood, you can make an argument for animal persons, but that's not an avenue we go down.
No, and the alternative, there's a very important religious or perhaps specifically Christian contribution to that. Can you give us a sense of the key elements of that image?
So that is based around communication. The theological concept of personhood has its origins in the Christological debates about how are we to understand Jesus from the 4th century. The Christians wrestling with the idea that, well, Jesus talks and acts as if he's God, and the scriptures write as if the Holy Spirit is God, but we know God is one. So how does this work out? Well, there are various different kind of models that are used, but the one that gains favour, particularly in the Latin church, is borrowing from a concept of Greek philosophy, actually originally the Greek theatre, prosopon, which is a mask, which Greek actors used to use to show their face, as it were, to be a character to the world. And that got translated into Latin as persona, from which we get our person. The idea is a person is the face you place towards the world, and that face is sort of a metonym, therefore, the way you interact with the world. So it's already a kind of a relational, communicative concept of personhood. And going back to some theology and the scriptures in writing this chapter, it really struck me two things. One, how in Genesis, God speaks creation into existence. And in Genesis 2, humans are given the task of categorizing, linguistically categorizing creation. And in the New Testament, the new Adam, Jesus, does an awful lot of stuff by speaking. And this is one of the things that really strikes his followers. You know, he speaks with authority. Not only does he speak, teach with authority, but he exercises what are known as speech act. In other words, he changes reality through speech. He forgives people through speech. He actually brings order to chaotic creation through speech. And of course, human beings are made in his image, are made in this image. So the more and more we looked at that, more and more it struck us that actually that capacity to speak, to be a relational being that communicates our personhood to the world and brings order to the world through our speech is critical to our personhood. And therefore, by that reasoning, you could argue that humans are persons. Non-human animals are not. Very important caveat there, though, which is that that doesn't mean if non-human animals are not persons, you get to treat them as you want. That clearly mustn't be the case.
Yeah, so it's the language, which is an act of communication that's central to who we are. And that, presumably that means between ourselves and each other, but also between us and God, perhaps. But how is this different from a capacity argument? Isn't that a capacity over some other lack of it?
So that's a very good point. And you could argue that speech is just another capacity.
That you could lose.
You could lose, but this whole conversation, as it were, takes place at a normative level rather than a descriptive level, because there are plenty of humans that don't have great cognitive capacity, can't speak, so on and so forth. But normally, one would expect them to. You know, if somebody loses their capacity for speech or hearing, whatever you say, that is a shame or a tragedy, because we would expect them to be able to do that. If a chimpanzee or an elephant can't speak, you don't say, oh my goodness, what a tragedy, because you don't expect them to. So we're existing here in what you would normally expect humans to do. Now, it's a very good point. Speech could be just said, well, it's another capacity. I mean, in one sense, of course, it is. But it's a different capacity. It's almost like a doorway through which we can be admitted to, as it were, a completely new world of imagination and creativity and moral reflection and discernment. So it is a capacity, but it's a kind of facilitating capacity.
All right, well, perhaps one more area that we look at in the book, and that is outer space and alien life. So it's an incredible human development in science that we can know more about the universe and planets, and endlessly fascinating and draws many scientists to discover more and more. And so the idea of alien life on other planets has occupied human thinking for some time, and that's certainly not abating as we get to know more about it, right?
Yeah, this is a great chapter, right? Because no one can prove you wrong. Unless, of course, yeah, you know, we do get this signature communication, in which case that chapter might need to be rewritten slightly. Although I hope what we say there would still bear weight. I mean, the numbers do the talking here. 100 billion stars in our galaxy, approximately. 100 billion galaxies in the universe. That's an awful lot of stars. Once upon a time, we thought, well, planets are unusual. But actually, for 30-odd years now, we've been detecting exoplanets, planets outside our solar system. I think NASA has identified about 5,000 now. There are about the same number on the waiting list, waiting to be confirmed. It seems that planets are pretty much ubiquitous as well. Now, we only have evidence for life on one planet, but what we do know is that life evolved here very quickly, comparatively speaking, more or less as soon as the conditions allowed it to. That kind of suggests that there's a good chance that life is very widespread in the universe. One of the people we spoke to, who was a cosmologist, said his money would be on one civilization per galaxy, which would be kind of a rather nice way of sharing civilization out. It's important to emphasize that, you know, life doesn't mean us. It can mean, you know, unicellular organisms, and for many, many, many planets that might be. But here's the thing. If we discover life elsewhere, many people say, oh, that's a real challenge to the Christian faith, because Christian faith is predicated on humans being unique. And therefore, if you discover life elsewhere, that's really going to put the kibosh on Christianity. And we argue almost exactly the opposite in our chapter.
Yes, well, can you tell us why it isn't such a threat in the way that some people imagine it to be?
So, two responses to that. The first is that people see it as a threat because people see human uniqueness as being the source of human value. The assumption is, Christianity says that God loves us as humans, and God loves us because we're special, unique. Well, up to a point, Lord Copper, right? All species are special. That's what the word means. Humans absolutely are special, but so are earthworms and so are magpies, okay? Yeah. Now, humans are unique, as we've just been talking about, in that, on this planet at least, we have a kind of a set of capacities, including communication and speech, to a greater extent than any other species do, that allows us to be the gardeners of creation, as it were. But really importantly, that's not the reason why God loves us. Okay, our value does not come simply because we are unique in that capacity, any more than parents love their child because she's an only child, or love that child less because they bring a newborn home from hospital. Love, at least according to the Christian view, is just an act of grace. It's an act of apportioning a worth and value to another thing, not because they deserve it, because transparently, a lot of the time, we don't. So I don't think the alien argument undermines the kind of accusations of anthropocentrism, because really, Christianity shouldn't be anthropocentric, it should be theocentric. And here's my second point, a bit more briefly. If we could show that there was life distributed throughout the cosmos, and even more so intelligent life and possibly reflective life, it might seem as if the entirety of the cosmos was a bit of a put-up job. That the principle of life and mind and maybe even love and communion was built in to the fabric right from the beginning, and that the entire universe is a machine, in inverted commas, for making minds or for making love. And I think that would be deeply consonant with a Christian understanding of reality.
Yes, and this idea that maybe there's some life on some even similar civilization on a distant planet, that God might choose to interact with whatever's happening there in some similar way, or doesn't seem to completely undermine what's happening here, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, the first thing to say, it's a lovely detail here, is this is not a new question. Not in the sense that we've been thinking about this since we've been sending people to the moon. We've been thinking about this since the 14th century. There are medieval theologians who wrote at some length on the idea of alien life elsewhere. And this was still in the Ptolemaic cosmos mind. It's extraordinary kind of mental exercises going on here. Well, if there were, what would that mean for the incarnation? And you have this idea of either other planets weren't fallen, therefore they didn't need an incarnation, or they were fallen, but we were to be missionaries bringing the news of Jesus to other planets, which is a really delightful kind of, you know, that's proper mission work, that is, isn't it? Or there's the idea of multiple incarnations. There's the little green Jesus idea, which is that the incarnation is more than simply about the atonement. It's about embodiment and presence, and therefore God might incarnate himself, God's self, other planets. Now, look, this is kind of mind-bending stuff. I'm not putting my cards on any of these particular options. But the great thing about it, it acts as a kind of mental gymnasium where you can think out, well, what does God mean? What does love mean? What does the incarnation mean? And kind of play them out in different scenarios, which is exactly what medieval theologians were doing.
I think sometimes the creative impulse of human beings and the unbelievable complexity of things that humans are capable of, that's reflective perhaps of a God who is similarly immensely creative. These are powerful things to think through, aren't they, as we consider all the implications that come out of, you know, are we unique? Are there things here we need to focus on and understand?
You're right in that this concept, the question of the true nature of the human or the human good, or it does preoccupy me. It almost frustrates me, really, because it's a kind of all roads lead to Rome type thing I have, whereby I'm getting involved in an issue and I think, well, if this leads to that, and that, oh, actually then the deep underlying question is, oh no, here I am again. The deep underlying question is how we think about the human. I mean, I'm not a Catholic, but I'm deeply attracted to that insistent principle about the... it's often very gender-specific language in Catholic social teaching, the nature of man, the nature of the person. I think it is so important. But picking up your point there, I think creativity is, it's in danger of being overlooked, really, with our obsession with autonomy and intelligence. I mean, it really strikes me. I mean, like you, Simon, my kids are a lot older now. When they were younger, you didn't need to teach them to want to draw and to play. Right? They did that naturally. I mean, you might need to teach them to draw because, you know, it wasn't very good. But you didn't need to teach them to want to draw and to want to put stuff together and to want to play. It's deeply there. In the same way as one of the things that really struck me is, you know, if you take the kids to the park, say, and they play on the swings or they're riding their bike or whatever it is, very often, particularly when they're super young, what they're saying is, Daddy, Daddy, look at me, look at me, look at me. So actually, what is as important to them as the activity they're doing is the recognition and relational respect and appreciation they get from their loved ones. This is who we are. It's as deep as you go, that creativity and that relationality. And it is, I think, quite striking that they are two of the themes that come out in so many interpretations of the meaning of the Imago Dei in Genesis 1. We're made in the image of a creative God, made in the image of a relational God.
This has been Life and Faith from CPX with me, Simon Smart. Thanks so much to Nick Spencer from Theos Think Tank in London. His latest of many excellent books, this time co-authored with Hannah Waite, is Playing God: Science, Religion and the Future of Humanity, and it is highly recommended. If you've enjoyed this episode and you know someone else you think might appreciate it, please do send it on to them. Welcome them into the Life and Faith world. We'd love to have more on board. Now, Life and Faith is only one of the things we do here at CPX, and if you would like to keep up with all the other activity, you can sign up to our newsletter. Go to publicchristianity.org, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And finally, again today, thank you to our producer, the barely human, Alan Douthwaite. Next week,
ethical foods tend to be a lot more expensive than foods that people perhaps on a regular standard income can purchase. So it creates this people can act and behave ethically if they have the money to do it.